Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 37, the final part, where we're discussing Xenophon's Oikonomikos, an ancient Greek Socratic dialogue about household management, with our special guest, Professor Peter Adamson of LMU in Munich and the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to parts 1 or 2 yet, it may be worth going and doing so now. Or if you'd like to just get the cliff notes of our discussion, then this is the place to be. Just to remind, this new structure that we have, part 1 is meant to introduce the text, and parts 2 and 3 are meant to offer a discussion of implications, with part 3 being also in place of what we used to do with summaries. So, without further ado, part 3 of episode 37. So now we talked about Xenophon for two parts of the episode, and I'd like to give a brief summary before we conclude the discussion. So a few words about the text. Oikonomikos, or a treatise on household management, is an ancient Greek Socratic dialogue between Socrates and a young fellow named Critobulus. Peter actually pointed out that it's three dialogues in one. One between Socrates and Critobulus, another one between Socrates and Ischomachus, and the third one between Ischomachus and his wife. And across these three dialogues, what we get is a discussion of what it means to be a virtuous and successful household manager. So we discussed in part one that household management for ancient Greeks was not necessarily that dissimilar from a small and medium business administration we have now, in that households were far larger. They were concerned with agricultural production, and they had a rudimentary division of labor. Some of these could reach the size of as much as 10,000 members, which is quite a significant size, definitely well beyond what we would think of household these days. So essentially in the dialogue, Critobulus, who is son of Crito, of the Platonic dialogue by the same name, he asks Socrates what would be kind of a good occupation for himself, how he would best conduct his household so that it is successful and that he makes a lot of money. And as Peter, as you said in part one, in great detail, that Socrates starts with immediately questioning this presupposition, that asking, are you sure that being rich is what you want to do? That is this really such a good thing? And this is one of the first aspects of the dialogue that we discussed in relation to contemporary management and organization theory, being that Socrates says that he has fewer societal obligations because he's poor, so he is not expected to contribute to the cultural development of his environment. And what this refers to is that large households in ancient Athens were expected to engage in lavish sacrifices and honor the gods in a proportionate way to their size. So Socrates, being poor and not having almost anything, felt himself free from these obligations and quite happy to be so. Whereas, as he told Critobulus, if you do develop a large household, then your societal obligations will be larger. And this has echoes to what actually some companies are trying to do now with the social enterprise and to a lesser extent with corporate social responsibility, that the idea in the stakeholder versus shareholder debate that we also covered in part one of the episode, that in ancient Greece, the stakeholder approach, so meaning that business is responsible to all those affected by it, is a default, whereas now the opposite seems to be more true, that businesses by default are indebted to their owners first and foremost. Something else we talked about was the importance of unity of command and of organization. And Xenophon gives an example of a neatly organized hull of a ship, and how everything being in its place is necessary for efficient conduct of sailing the seas, as it were. And this is given as an example of importance of being organized and having everything lean within household management as well. Then this also relates to an interesting philosophical point given by Socrates, that what counts as assets is only that which brings one objective good, meaning that not everything that a person or an organization possesses is an asset. So unless what an organization possesses can be used to bring benefit, then that would be a that should be discarded and considered a liability. So for instance, Peter gave an example of drug addict with a lot of money will do him or herself harm as opposed to good. And money in that sense cannot be considered to be a an asset, because it actually serves to deteriorate the health of the owner. So money or other resources, in the absence of knowledge of how to use them for in a virtuous way, are not a possession but a liability. Then as the dialogue proceeds, we get some more insight into kind of basic motivational techniques and opinions of ancient Greeks, as these are not particularly sophisticated either, at least as it comes through in this dialogue, and they can be summarized as if you want people to work hard for you, you should be nice to them. We discussed in part two how that is inconsistent with the tradition of scientific management, where being nice to people was not a concern, and where the philosophy of Frederick Winslow Taylor, our good old friend on the podcast, whom we keep coming back to, was more concerned with being just rather than nice. He was perfectly fine being downright mean to his employees as long as he would not be unfair to them. But that is, of course, a different conversation, and you can catch up on that in episode one. Finally, we have a theme of learning and knowledge management, as it were. And Socrates seems to advocate the importance of gaining knowledge on the one hand, from the source. So he goes to learn about management from a person he considers to be successful in this area, Ischomachus, who's like a big successful businessman in Athens at the time. And second, this idea that Peter pointed out to be uncommon in this general Socratic philosophical tradition, that you know more than you think you do. So by and large, Socratic dialogues would aim to show the opposite, that people actually know less than they think they do. Whereas here, Ischomachus demonstrates to Socrates that by means of observation alone, he knows more about agriculture than he thinks he does. This, of course, has echoes to Polanyi's tacit versus explicit knowledge, where individuals would know more than they'd be able to articulate, and this would come through as evidence by means of practicing knowledge or know-how, and not either codifying or consuming it via codified form. Now, something you mentioned, Peter, at the end of part two is this effort that you're making of trying to figure out how to learn from the texts that have some, as you said, repugnant attitudes towards other people or women within them. And I totally agree that reading this, and we did come back to this time to time, that reading this text and how Ischomachus refers to his wife in a downright patronizing way is not something we'd like to take on board through reading this text. But then there's also other aspects that are, well, on one hand, interesting and noteworthy, and on the other hand, maybe something that we lost through the multiple industrial revolutions and the complexification of the organization of labor, that maybe wouldn't be such a bad thing to regain. And perhaps an argument can be made that there is a movement towards doing exactly that. So the environment within which organizations exist, as described by Xenophon, is very community-oriented. So we talked about how organizations, well, households in the ancient Athens context were expected to contribute to the development of their communities pro rata to their size, which is not the case anymore these days. and how this effort on community would be considered of great value in Athens at the time. Indeed, there is a very distinct emphasis on socialization between people and how organizations and how working for organizations ought not impede these processes of socialization. For example, this comes through very distinctly in the beginning when Socrates tells Critobulus why farming is a more virtuous occupation than, say, some form of artisanal manufacturing that would be an alternative. That why people who work farms and administer farms are more valuable and respected members of society. And the reason for this is that because of the temporality of work that comes with agriculture and probably a large amount of slaves that would be actually working the fields, people who engage in farm labor have more time to go to the marketplace and to socialize and to talk with their fellow citizens, whereas people who engage in manufacturing essentially work in solitude inside all day, which is a really distinct echo, at least for me, to how offices and how the cubicle movement was as well, that people would be isolated from one another and made to sit indoors all day, and in some cases socialization would be explicitly prohibited or discouraged.
Well, so I have a comment about that. I tend to agree with you, Demetrius, that there's this theme of the obligations of the well-off or the wealthy to society in general. And I also think you have a point there about this, the view, at least of Xenophon, who, as Peter pointed out earlier, is a rich man and a very well-off, seeing the artisans and the craftsmen as separate from the either the landholders or the people who were, you know, providing directly for society's food needs and that sort of thing. So one of the things I thought was interesting, and I think it was in episode one, you talked about how there's this idea where I think it's Socrates was talking about how he's actually better off than Xenophon because he doesn't have all the obligations of society when he enumerates many of them, you know, about feeding soldiers and providing food and raising armies and, you know, those kinds of things. And in many ways in our modern society, we've reduced a lot of that to just financial contributions, right? Well, we'll just tax them more and you know, that's how they'll contribute to society. And perhaps we've lost something, lost a bit of that recognition that appears so strongly in this work that the people who are better off or more well able financially have this larger duties to society. And whether it's in the way that Xenophon describes specifically or in, you know, helping society flourish, I think there's many ways you can look at that. So I think that is an aspect of something that either perhaps we've lost or is muted in our current life.
I'd like to follow up with that. It seems like Xenophon's work that the focus of the leader is down, whereas in modern society, a lot of the focus tends to be up and out. And I hear that contrast quite a bit in my current line of work, where the external obligations of the household, of what Critobulus was talking about, those are sort of like the natural trappings of or expectations of the leader, and the leader just say kind of has to do that as part of what they give back to society. Whereas it seems like nowadays the leader's primary orientation is how to sell the organization. You see that in a lot of Mintzberg's roles. You see that in a lot of other ways. You know, where does the leader spend their energy? It's going to be on the road, selling the organization, promoting the products, doing all of this stuff. And the internal workings of the organization, the looking down is put to somebody else. And I think, it's a fair question as to have we tipped the balance a little bit too far? Are we putting our leaders in a position where we're granting that, you know, they are basically able to do this to the neglect of their organizations? And therefore, now what we see is perhaps a little bit of rebellion against it, if you will. They
right, or,
you
know, or alienation, right? Workers feel alienated.
Alienation, because, yes.
Yeah.
Although, I think, I mean, one of you mentioned before the importance of the leader being hands-on. And in fact, you get this very large-scale example of that in the Economicus, where Cyrus, this Persian leader that Xenophon actually fought a war for, he's praised for being interested in agriculture. And the way that his practice is described is that he literally like goes around and quite literally hands-on gets involved in planting trees. He knows exactly what's going on. He's physically there.
Yeah, inspecting helping. The gardens, you know, evaluating what's going on. Yes, very, very active role.
And so, I mean, on the one hand, I think we might admire that because you get this, like you just said, this very strong advice not to become remote and detached from what the people in your organization, your underlings, are doing. But on the other hand, there's still this sort of touching faith in the magic presence of the great leader, who just by turning up and getting involved will make everything come out all right, because the whole thing, I mean, the success of the whole thing flows from his virtue. And ultimately, Xenophon's focus is much more about the virtue of the leader and how it can be communicated to other people to different degrees, right? So slaves get less of it than the wife, for example. But the focus is all on how virtue sort of flows downhill. And it's not about the idea that you might be able to set up structures of good management, which are almost impervious to, or, you know, it doesn't matter who's in charge because the structure is so well designed that you can pretty much just put a halfway competent person at the top and everything will just run like a well-oiled machine. He doesn't have that idea at all. And I think that's in general not a very common idea in ancient Greece. So there's not as much faith as we probably have today in the idea of well-managed bureaucratic structures that can function independently of the virtuous leader who's actually making sure everything happens the way it should happen.
I love that you mentioned bureaucracy in this context, because that is completely true, that bureaucracy, as we at least know from Weber, was only made possible with the proliferation of the rational legal type of authority. And you can listen to us talk about Weber in episode 9. I'll just remind that Weber distinguished between three types: the traditional, charismatic, and this rational legal. And traditional being hereditary authority, so kind of what, well, actually, probably almost exclusively what Xenophon is witnessing here. Charismatic being that of a leader being persuasive to other people and getting them to follow him or her. But then the rational legal, the one that kind of comes along with industrialization and the one on which bureaucracy is based and predicated, is one in where authority and leadership is a function of a legally prescribed office. So, as I mentioned in the part two, I think that we shouldn't conflate owners or foremen of Xenophon's time with managers, as we understand today, because there's a lot more that goes into management as a both a profession and a position. And this is kind of, this has a lot to do with that as well, that managers are a position made possible by the rational legal type of authority, in Weberian terms, which simply did not exist at the time of ancient Greece, or for quite some time afterwards. I think the Roman Republic has some semblance with the positions like the tribune of the plebs that they had, and then military tribunes, but still, by and large, it was a very traditional, as in hereditary, type of governmental society. Ancient Greece, even less so, from what I know. And so, yeah, this is a great point. Xenophon simply did not, and people in Xenophon's time simply did not have the tools on which to base a structure that would sustain an organization of any kind. They did not have the conceptual apparatus of a legal office in the modern sense of the word. It was far more individual centric than it seems, and far less processual as it is now. And then, of course, you need to keep in mind that the environment within which organizations existed was far less complex back in Xenophon's time than it is now. Because now organizations have to worry about a myriad of things, ranging from market forces and competition to technological disparity to kind of broader macroeconomic forces and consumer preferences and all that sort of thing. Whereas in Xenophon's time in ancient Athens, unless something went really, really wrong, the only plausible risk to the existence of a household was pretty much just natural forces. So this is explained in this dialogue that as long as the householder does things right and does things right consistently, he's fine. The household is expected to last, you know, unless it gets destroyed by adverse weather conditions or by war or something like that. It's expected to last pretty much indefinitely. It's there is no expiry date that is conceivably placed upon this business model.
And passed on to your children, right? By the way, maybe before we stop, we should at least mention that, because people might wonder, is there any actual economics in the Economicus? And there is at least one really brilliant thing that he mentions, which maybe might strike you as so obvious that it's not exciting, but it is exciting because as far as I know, it's one of the first passages in history to mention this fact. It's a kind of a jokey passage where Socrates says something about growing grain and then deliberately selling it where there's a grain shortage because you can get a higher price, right? And actually, it struck me, it's easy to read past because it goes by really fast. So it's a brief passage, but it struck me because I recently covered medieval economic theory in my podcast. And that idea that price might be sensitive to demand is something that they really struggled with and had a hard time conceptualizing from Aristotle onwards. And so I thought it was really interesting to see that Xenophon is completely comfortable with that idea and can even kind of make jokes about it. So it shows you that they were always kind of conscious that this was an issue. And it was, you know, presumably an everyday occurrence that they could observe quite easily. But trying to understand that in a more systematic way took them a long, long time. But still, it's interesting that Xenophon actually makes the observation here. And so that's a proper economic observation. So at least there's some economics in the Economicus.
Yeah, the other one I noticed was where they talk about what define what a good is, right? And they come to the conclusion it's only something that serves you or provides you benefit, because they talk about whether enemies could be goods or relationship with friends could be good. So that's also I would say a reference to economics.
Yeah, there's actually, it helps there if you know the Greek word. So the Greek word at stake is chaimata, which literally means things that you can use or things that are useful. So the word here for goods or assets actually means things that are useful. So when Socrates says, well, they're not really chaimata unless they're doing you some good, right? And that's why Critobulus says, oh yeah, sure, that makes sense, because he's thinking about what the word means. And so it goes back to something I said way back at the beginning of our conversation in part one, that, for example, wealth might not be helpful to some people because they're just going to spend the money badly. So that in a way, that's, they're playing on the Greek word there.
I also thought it eliminated this whole idea of collections, right? Many times we see collections or collectors as a good in some forms, particularly if it's art. And here was this example. So if it's not something you're actually using, then it really isn't a good. So I thought that was an interesting contrast.
Yeah. And in fact, you might think that something was an asset or a good, even though it's actually harming you. So right. You could be wrong about right. Whether your property is benefiting you or not.
So do you think that goes back to this, the notion of the focus, a lot of these writing, these kinds of writings or writings of the time on ethics and virtue, that because that plays a strong role, if it didn't connect to ethics and virtue, that's one of the reasons why it wasn't viewed as a good?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And in fact, I would even say it's a specifically Socratic way of conceiving virtue. This is something you get very strongly from Plato's portrayal of Socrates. And this, I think, must go back to the real Socrates, the historical Socrates, that he thought that there was a very close relationship between virtue and knowledge. In fact, maybe he even thought they were the same thing, so that knowing how to behave and being a good person are the same thing. And one of the arguments that he would give for that was basically, if you don't know what you're doing, then things will always go badly for you. Whereas if you do know what you're doing, things will always go well for you. So you'll kind of be an excellent or flourishing human being. And that's just what we mean by a virtuous human being. So, you know, it's, and this goes back to ideas that we already mentioned, like the Cynics or Socrates himself, you know, knowing what you need, what you don't need, knowing how to use what you have. And I think they would even say, certainly Aristotle would say, that if you're rich, then that would be a good thing for you as long as you use your wealth virtuously. But if you don't use it virtuously, then it's at best neutral and probably it's bad for you to be rich.
Or destructive, right? We talked about vices and people spend their money on things that don't do them well.
Exactly. And of course, the ultimate example here would again be the leader, because the vicious leader is bad for himself, but he's bad for everyone around him too. So we could think of vicious political leaders in our own time. You know, the vice in their soul is causing vice to sort of spread like a cancer throughout the entire society. Exactly. Yes. And that's certainly what Plato and Aristotle thought. And I guess that Xenophon might think something like that too, based on what he says here in the Economicus.
So one observation as we're closing out now, I just want to say it's been really valuable talking with you, Peter, to get your perspective, because you can read Economicus, I think, just as a work as it exists, and I strongly encourage our listeners to do so. But the extra context you provide about the way they thought and talked about virtue and how it related to their other writings has been fascinating and very illuminating for me, because I would not have gotten that depth of understanding without your extra information. So I really appreciate you doing that.
It's actually interesting for me to see what you guys made of it too, because, you know, you're coming at it from this very different angle than the one I'm used to. I think it's interesting that maybe you would expect me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It sort of shows that if you start thinking about business and management hard enough, you just wind up doing philosophy.
That's what I always say.
Oh, no, it's great. It's a great insight. I completely agree with you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Peter. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us and our listeners.
Yes, I enjoyed it a great deal. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's all for episode 37. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Peter. And if you have, and maybe this sparked an interest in philosophy for you, do check out his podcast, History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps, which can be found on iTunes or through his website, historyofphilosophy.net. Please join us next week as we are going to discuss a famous ethnographic study of police socialization by Van Manen here on Talking About Organizations.